Hello, it's the 23rd of June. This is episode 98 of the Crate and Crowbar podcast, a podcast about PC gaming. I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Graham Smith.
And...
Chris Thurston.
And there's quite a lot of news this week. There's Batman, which we'll get to. But before the Batman news, there was some indie game news that was particularly interesting to me. When Tale of Tales, the creators of Sunset and The Path and...
The Graveyard and
Luxurious Superbia, which was a game about fingering a flower.
Yep.
Announced that they were... They didn't really close, did they? They haven't closed. They've stopped making games. They did a blog post which they said that they have... we won't make games again, or certainly not commercial games.
Yeah.
And this was because Sunset, their new game, had sold only 4,000 copies in its first month on sale, including all of the copies that they... that people got at Kickstarter rewards when they first backed the Kickstarter a while back, and including, most amazingly, a 50% off Steam sale in the summer sale, which is actually, if you don't follow the numbers of these things, that is insane. Like, Steam sales, you sort of expect them to do well if anyone's heard of your game at all, and you don't do 50% off within a month of launching. That's, like, absolute nuclear option. That's if, you know, nothing else has worked, and they said that, basically. So I'm surprised it didn't sell better anyway, because it's a sort of Gone Home alike that looks quite pretty in the screenshots, got loads of press coverage. And I'm doubly surprised that going half off so soon after launching didn't make a dramatic difference.
Yeah.
But it led to kind of an interesting discussion about, you know, what qualifies as a success and what qualifies as a failure in indie games. And David Pitman, the creator of Eldritch and more recently Neonstruct, posted his sales figures and said he had mixed feelings reading their blog post, because they sold 4,000 in their launch month and Neonstruct apparently sold 1,000 in his launch month, and he doesn't consider it a failure.
Yeah.
Because he spent... in Tale of Tales blog post, they mentioned something about, like, after the Kickstarter, after they'd already got their public funding, they decided at some point to spend an extra 40,000 on, I can't remember what it was, but some extra expense, thinking, oh, we'll make that easily back in the first month. And David... said that his entire budget for Neonstruct was $53,000. And he also mentioned his sales figures, well, his total profits from Eldritch, which were $400,000 in total gross, like ever, lifetime. And that's with an expansion as well. I don't know if that's included. Of which $120,000 was taken by Steam and $100,000 was taken by tax. So that leaves him with $280,000. All right.
No, yeah, 180,000.
Yeah. So tax is crazy. It pays a lot of tax.
Like, that means, you know, if you spent 53,000 making Neonstruct, you can make two more games on just the money you made from Eldritch, not counting the money that's hopefully continuing to come in from both Eldritch and now Neonstruct.
Well, he said Neonstruct wasn't a failure because he thinks it will break even in the long run. But he also said it would have to make 150,000 to break even, which is a lot more than he's made so far, I suppose. I suppose, actually, I can't remember what price it is, so I don't know what 1,000 copies translates to. But still, I'm really... That's a much scarier kind of thing to come out of this, is... Because with Sunset... I mean, Gone Home itself was controversial, but sold well, ultimately, because it won loads of Game of the Year awards. And actually, it sold quite slowly at first, and then only picked up after it started to get Game of the Year awards and massive critical acclaim. So that was a kind of slow burner. Not very slowly. It was still a massive success before that. But Sunset is like that. And then there are some reasons it wouldn't do as well as Gone Home, in that it's Heritage, although they're a very well-established developer, they're not Bioshock developers. And that's a kind of magic word for, I think, a lot of Steam users in particular. So that was kind of... Like I said, I was surprised, but it wasn't totally crazy. But then Neonstruct, I feel like it's such a gamer's game, and it's kind of like... I feel like it's in my wheelhouse a little bit, although I said... previously, though, I'm not really the target audience because I'm not after a pure stealth game, but it's so aimed at Deus Ex fans, and I kind of think of that as my audience as well. And I don't want my audience to be 1,000 people, because if it is, I'm fucked.
Like, I think the mark against Neonstruct is you look at it and it looks in screenshots incredibly basic, which isn't a problem that Sunset has. I mean, Sunset's got a much stronger art direction and looks quite nice, whereas Neonstruct can look nice in certain screenshots when you've got nice neon lighting and signage going on, but a lot of the time just looks like grey on textured rooms in a grey on textured world. I wonder if it was hurt by the fact that it's called Neonstruct and previously it was not called Diogen der Welt or something like that.
That is still part of the title.
Yeah, it's Neon Struck title. Which is, I think, probably a lot of people look at and then look at the pictures and think, fuck this thing, whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, Eldritch is a very straightforward pitch for a game in terms of what it kind of evokes.
Yeah, and it had a little. It was procedural, and it had a little bit of Minecraftiness in that the world was destructible.
Yeah.
So it wasn't creative; you weren't building things, but it just had that recognizable. Oh, this is a blocky Minecraft-style game, but a dungeon crawler at the same time.
Do you think it looked better than Neon Struct?
I think, yeah, it did. It just did. I think there was more stuff in Eldritch's environment that was immediately recognizable or just fun-looking, in terms of the. The Cthulhu-esque monsters and guns and stuff like that, versus the humanoid guards in Neon Struct, where it suffers more for the fact that it's low poly.
Mm.
Like that, there's a really strong. I mean, I like Eldritch. I reviewed it and didn't actually rate it like mega high, only because I thought that the challenge level was not pitched quite right, and that may well have been fixed in kind of in subsequent. Games, but like there's a really strong early trailer for Eldritch that is basically does quite a good job of going, hey, this is basically Cthulhu Spelunky Doomcraft.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, so, and that's, you know, that it does a really good job of expressing itself quickly. I think, like, it took me someone else explaining it to me to get what Neon Struct was, I think. That, you know, this is a tribute to Liberty Island from Deus Ex, everybody loves. It's a little bit more abstract and less kind of.
Yeah, actually, thinking back to it, the trailer for Neon Struct, it's very stylish and very kind of cool, but I guess you don't really. I think it like maybe communicates roughly what the game is, but doesn't sort of make your mind explode with the possibilities necessarily, because it, like the appeal of the game is really down to, you know, the refinement of honing a particular kind of pure stealth game and the thrill of doing that, and that's probably a tough thing to communicate in a trailer.
Mm.
The thing that always impressed me about Eldritch was I think he made it in, 9 months. He quit his job and set himself a certain deadline based on basically the savings that he had. And so the fact that that's made $400,000, even before tax and Steam take their cut, $400,000 for 9 months' work? That's a pretty good return on his investment.
Yeah.
You know, you can look at these sales stats sometimes and think, oh, everything's fucked, but you have to look very far to find pretty decent examples of things are better than they've ever been.
Mm. Yeah, and presumably, I mean, I don't think he's too worried because the 400,000 is not his lifetime total for Eldritch, for his lifetime. It's still selling, right? Presumably, I don't know, but anything that's made $400,000 in that period of time is probably still selling a certain number of copies every day and will continue to get a big boost in each Steam sale. And now he's got two games out, so he's got two games that can potentially have that kind of success and that. I think that's probably how an indie studio can work now. I guess your first thing can't be a total flop, but if you can run very lean and just survive on, David's working costs are just his living costs, and then after it gets published, he has to pay off some other debts. But he can basically make games for as long as he can afford to pay for his own living expenses, and that way you can kind of build up a portfolio.
He said on Twitter that pretty much explicitly that was his strategy, was to have a broad portfolio of games that were continuing to sell. He figured that was the only way in which to make a living. His brother is also an indie game developer, though.
Yeah, they're actually the same company.
Yeah, and his brother did an interesting post 6 months ago about sales figures for Super Win the Game, is that what it's called? Which was he originally released this free retro platformer that got a huge amount of attention. Kotaku picked up on it. It got posted on dozens of websites. Hundreds of thousands of people played it. It was a little in your browser type free game. And then he spent a year or more expanding on it, polishing it up, making it much, much better. And then I think he sold a few hundred copies in his first month. And so he wrote an interesting blog post about that. How about 6 months ago? Maybe the problem is just that it's really unpredictable what's going to be successful. Because, like you said, Sunset is kind of a gone home alike. It doesn't seem unreasonable to think that it would do all right purely on that basis.
I mean, didn't that would be an underserved
market?
That is the other part of it, I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I haven't played it, so I sort of a bit shy of wading into that, but Gone Home was sort of very well received by people. And
yeah, it got crazy reviews.
And I know people that have talked about Sunset to me and their experiences with it and who were unsatisfied with it in a bunch of ways. And so that's a really basic thing. It doesn't take a lot of extra information, really, to kind of flesh out the argument a little bit. That if people weren't liking it as much, then hopefully that still has a bearing on what is successful and what isn't.
Hopefully.
It'll be interesting because I looked at the Steam review positivity percentages for Gone Home and Sunset, and they're the same. Sunset has far fewer reviews, but they both have 75% positive, which is... It's tricky. It's hard to know what that means, because I think in the case of Gone Home, I think that's a big crowd of people who bought it because they knew a lot about it and knew a lot about what it was going to be, and then all of them loved it. And then the other 25% are people who just sort of picked it up from the buzz because it was so talked about and had so many Game of the Year awards and stuff. And obviously, there's a massive anti-Gone Home contingent on Steam. Mm-hmm. And so I think like the 25% of people who didn't like Gone Home are probably people who will not like anything in the genre of Gone Home, hate walking simulators, basically, and were sort of caught up with the buzz about it. And just, you know, if everyone's saying it's good, it must be great. Whereas Sunset, I suspect there aren't that many of those people. I mean, there can't be that many because they only sold 4,000 copies. So I think the 25% people who bought it didn't pick it up because everyone was raving about this thing. They sort of, they wanted to like a walking simulator and didn't like this particular one, so maybe.
It's interesting, like, I wonder about, like, because I believe the Stanley Parable was very successful as well. Which is, and Dear Esther was, and Dear Esther probably being the first of the walking simulators in a major way. I see something sort of interesting there is that both Stanley Parable and Dear Esther came from Half-Life mods, which is sort of kind of interesting origin that these things do have their roots in. And maybe that helps to a degree that they have their roots so much in something people might have previously encountered in like a very traditional games context rather than purely at that sort of an art scene or whatever. But like, I think maybe the case with Stanley Parable was that this theorizing, but there's really nothing like it. Like, you can't look at it and think of anything else. Like, you can look at Sunset and maybe see shades of like Gravity Bone partly and Gone Home, maybe even Papers, Please or something in that direction. Like, you know, it's a we should probably explain it's a game about exploring an apartment during a revolution, and those sorts of themes have been evoked in games before, so maybe the novelty isn't there. I don't want to theory craft too much about why a game wouldn't sell, but every really standout example I can think of in that genre that did do well had a really strong novelty factor. Like, you know, Dear Esther was unprecedented. Gone Home was largely unprecedented in how domestic it was, whereas Dear Esther was this kind of, like, you know, mystical or spiritual thing. Stanley Parable still doesn't look or sound like anything else. And then, you know, maybe that's weirdly why something like Tacoma is taking the direction it is. You have to kind of keep moving this stuff into an environment that people wouldn't necessarily be so familiar with. Although space stations are maybe a little more familiar to a lot of games.
If it turns out that novelty and being really good are the two keys to success, then that's very reassuring. That would be great if that's the main indicators.
I'm sure a lot of the success of the Stanley Parable is just that it's funny, and it had very funny trailers. Or just like the video that they did of the narrator reading out an email that they received from a reader, you know, like, didn't really advertise the game in any sense, other than, hey, these people must be funny and it's got this voice in it. But 2 years before the game came out, that had a couple of million views on YouTube just because it was getting shared around.
Humor is really underestimated, I think, in terms of what sells games.
Although that's harder to explain the success of Dear Esther, perhaps.
Again, I think it's that unprecedented thing. I think it's this, you know, hey, you never really played anything like this. And also, I think maybe
that was very pretty as well.
Very pretty. Mm. It's also from a time when that came out during an era when this sounds like millions of years ago now, where people were really concerned with the notion that games might aspire to a higher kind of field of creative study. You know, the kind of art games art stuff, which all bounced off the late Roger Ebert and that kind of thing. And you know, I believe that question was ultimately satisfactorily answered and made irrelevant by the existence of games that were like, well, if you know, of course they can be, because there's loads of these games that qualify. So, but Dear Esther, you know, in terms of reactionary mobs moving around the internet angrily defending a perceived threat to their medium, at that time, something like Dear Esther I think was closer to being a, you know, being supported by quote unquote gamers, because it was a way of, you know, getting back at the mean old men that were saying that what we liked wasn't art. Whereas now, the opposite is true, where now those things are seen as politically located somewhere else and therefore are to be shunned. And like, we've had an amazing experience this week. A game I haven't played yet, but I'm really looking forward to playing, is Her Story, which is out soon, I think.
Yeah, Tom talked about it in the last podcast.
Yeah. Tomorrow afternoon.
Or one fall afternoon.
Okay. So by the time this podcast goes up, it will be out.
So, you know, Andy Kelly reviewed Her Story for us, and, you know, it's this, game about piecing together a mystery based on watching videos and searching for keywords based on the videos. And, Andy loves detective games more than anyone I know, and has lots of opinions about them, and says it's, you know, probably the best detective game he's ever played. Like, just on its own merits, no one has ever successfully done, we've talked about this before, no one has ever successfully done the drama of information that well before. And it happens to just, you know, to be comprised of video of an actress playing a woman in a police interview. But because it's called Her Story and prominently features a woman, but only in the sense that any story might or might not feature a woman, and we gave it a 90, not in order to support an agenda, but because it was a good computer game. The comments are just absolute wasteland now, because it's just how did you get, you got paid off. There was a great one that said that we were so frightened of RPS that we couldn't not give this game a thing. There's a guy who was like, if this was his story, you'd have given it 10.
what do they imagine that games press outlets can do to each other? How could one be sort of like terrified about?
I know, and if you know John, it's like, you know, really a big kind of cuddly, very friendly man, like turning up at our office, like, you know, dead-eyed, kind of like ready for the reckoning, because we dared not, you know, not support the game with a woman in it. But it literally, now it's enough that a game be slightly unorthodox and prominently feature a woman in any capacity, even if it is as a character in a drama that also includes men.
It's funny, actually. I remember hearing about Her Story ages back and thinking it sounded immensely boring, because it was just described to me as like, oh, you just watched this really long interview and basically you eventually figure out what's going on, there's lies and stuff, and that just didn't seem appealing. And then as soon as Tom said that it's split up into these like thousands of very brief clips and you have to find them by searching for keywords, and you can only find the relevant thing if you know what to search for, then instantly that's a game. That's really interesting and exciting, and I want to play it.
Yeah. I mean, and I know, and I hope it does well as well, because it's, you know, unorthodox and it's only costs a fiver, and, you know, obviously took a shitload of work to do and, you know, should be supported. But I suspect it will again be the political environment that's being released to now maybe compromises its potential success a little bit in the opposite direction, where it's now the bad novel, bad form of novel, where it's to be given derogatory Steam tags until some sort of unspecified victory condition is met.
Speaking of derogatory Steam tags, etc., etc., segue. Batman Arkham Knight came out today on PC.
Did it?
And people are displeased with the quality of the PC port. It seems that perhaps it is not as optimized as one might have hoped.
It has a 35% positive rating in the Steam reviews, which is crazy. I look at these things quite a lot, so like, a good game gets more than 90%, and only if it's good and it gets less than 90%, it has to be controversial, like Gone Home. And 75% makes you think, what's wrong with this game? And like 60% is like, whoa, what the fuck happened here? 35 is like it's child porn or something. Like, there's something, like, it gives you a virus.
Tom, you and I both played it, right?
Yes.
How does it run for you?
It's actually fine for me, after all the drama. I mean, it is one of the big complaints is that it's capped to 30 frames per second, which you can disable by editing any file, which I didn't do because I just thought, well, let's just see how it runs as packaged. And so far it's not actually bothering me that it runs at 30 FPS, and maybe that's why I'm not noticing any problems, because maybe it's like, if it's running at 60 and it keeps dipping to 30, that's weird.
Was about to say that. So I did a thing today for PC Gamer, just to kind of, we felt like we should test it a bit, and I found that it was okay, with some problems that I'll get to, at 30 frames a second. Then I quit you know, made those any changes, went back in, and even though I could get steady 60 frames a second in some parts, it would so regularly, you know, dip between 60 and 30, really, basically depending on, seemingly lighting conditions was one of them, and how fast I was moving in the Batmobile, that kind of thing. And I found that distracting. Like, I found the change in frame rate so distracting, I put it back to locked at 30 and enjoyed it more.
Right.
And I suspect that's why they locked it at 30.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's bad. That, you know, the rig I'm playing it on, it can run GTA 5 on max settings at 60 frames a second without any problem. It's a very high-end rig. So there's no way a new game should have that problem.
Yeah.
So that's bad in and of itself. But, you know, really, I think the INI tweak is the wrong way of solving it.
The funny thing is, I just upgraded recently, and it's so recently that I've only really played one game since I upgraded, which was The Witcher 3, and that already ran nearly perfectly, and now it runs perfectly. Although even that, with the, if you turn on Geralt's hair, then it goes at only 55 frames a second instead of 60. But I've just got, for the last few years, I've just been used to games running well, but not quite perfectly, just like maybe not 60 FPS at all times. And so, even though it is really bad that after I've upgraded, Batman doesn't run perfectly and, you know, basically does 30 FPS, occasionally dipping maybe a little bit below that, but not that noticeably, it just kind of feels fine to me, because that's just what I'm used to from games. obviously, I'm sure they're going to patch it, and I'm sure it'll get better, and it should.
It also, like, I do have the problem where it noticeably drops frames when you get in the Batmobile, or it moves too quickly.
Hmm.
And I was playing with it a lot, and I suspect it's not, you know, it's a texture issue, or a texture streaming issue is the best I could come up with. Because people seem to be having the fewest problems who have it installed on an SSD.
Right.
Whereas my work PC certainly doesn't have enough space on its SSD to it's a 40 gig game, so it's a bit of an ask. but like, I consistently found, especially if I was driving around testing it after immediately having loaded the game, it really, really struggled with textures. Right. Like, I took some screenshots of, like, you know, me standing next to a giant neon sign, which is obviously using the texture it's intended to use at the maximum level of detail. Another is, like, Batman putting his hand out to, like, press buttons on a control panel, but the control panel is just this blur. Like, this is mush. It looks like, you know, someone's, like, spattered a little bit of paint on a metal panel, and they're supposed to be, like, it's supposed to be words or buttons on something, and he's stroking it. I got another one of him lifting up a goon to interrogate him, and the guy doesn't really have any textures. Like, Batman is beautifully textured because Batman's always on screen, so there's, you know, he's kind of like, you know, amazing, hyper detailed,
fully loaded.
Yeah, a very, very detailed Batman, and in a quite detailed city as well, and a very detailed Batmobile in the background. But just a plasticine man dangling from his hand with like a helmet on, where it doesn't have any kind of texture map at all, so it's just the kind of like lighting map for metal or whatever. Like, it's kind of like, like old 3D Max, you know, graphics benchmark test surfaces thing. It's complete shit. Really, really shit in that moment. And it's like every single character in the game is Clayface apart from Batman. and that is not good at all. It's probably the really advanced point I was going to make. I think, you know, I don't usually like the kind of, you know, burn it all down bandwagonry that follows this kind of thing, or the narratives that got spun out of it. But, you know, the statement from Warner said that they had outsourced it.
Yeah.
Had outsourced the...
We and our external PC development partner are very concerned about this.
Yeah, yeah.
You're who? I'm sorry, what?
I believe, based on a rumour, that it's one of the Warner's internal studios in Canada that did it.
People have looked through Batman's credits, and they're ascribing it to Iron Glass Games or something like that.
Right.
There was a name that's being passed around, which makes that statement from Rocksteady or Warner say, us and the guys that did this.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Us and the people whose fault this is. Looking into it very seriously.
Like, if this launch had gone perfectly, they would not have ever mentioned the fact that they outsourced it.
Yes.
They would have taken all the credit. But now the things have gone wrong.
Yeah.
They've left little breadcrumbs that, you know, every news story about...
I'm not going to make any assumptions about the circumstances of the developer that did it, because you don't know what under pressure they were working under, like, to meet day-and-date release dates and so on, but... I said this in the thing I wrote today, I'd say that if you were considering buying it, and I think we've probably both gone to say, you could consider buying it because it's quite good, is that it's basically still in development. Like, give it a couple of weeks, it'll be finished. It's not finished.
It's effectively delayed on PC.
Yeah, exactly. This is the other form of delayed on PC, I guess.
From what else you played of it, are you enjoying punching the mans? Are you enjoying running over the mans in your Batmobile car?
Yeah, I've played, like, I think about an hour, and so it's mostly tutorial stuff and plot development stuff. I've actually been recording myself playing it as, like, a Let's Play, and what I'm saying for that hour is almost entirely complaints and mocking it and saying, what the fuck, at various things. But with a few nasty bits aside, it's actually a pretty good opening in terms of it briskly takes you through the different tutorial bits in a very seamless way where they all tie into a plot thing that is also sort of the intro to the game. It's all kind of seamless. There isn't really like a kind of, and then it fades to the credits and then you're somewhere else or anything. And it does a couple of neat tricks where you sort of think you're watching a cinematic and then you realise you're in control. Well, the first of those, it does that without telling you.
Yeah.
And
you can be sat there like a twat for a long time.
Yeah. And it's not, I don't feel, I was sat there like a twat, but I don't feel like I'm the twat here. Yeah. Like they're the twat.
Well, the
because, how am I supposed to know? Because your cutscenes are boring. You often do very boring things, and you often expect me to sit there and just wait and wait and wait. And if I press a button, you skip it without warning, and then I don't know if I missed something.
Yeah,
on this occasion, you've got to press buttons.
There's the line that immediately follows it, at this point, I think, includes the line, I pressed the button myself. That line should be dynamic based on how long it took you to press the button. Like, I pressed the button myself after waggling the sticks a bit and cautiously testing to see what the skip button was.
Yeah, I remember the end of Hitman Blood Money involves a scene like that, and very, very, very like that. It's almost the exact same scene. And you have to sort of mash buttons to make something happen. But it's the very end of the game, and if you do that, then the epilogue happens, and you play that, and it's kind of an extra mission. But many people did not realise you could press any buttons, quite understandably, and just think the game ends there. And plot-wise, it's a very dark moment to end on. Like, it dramatically changes the ending of the game. So those things are done. In terms of like the mechanic stuff, I guess I've done all of the basic things now. So I've done punching, and that has changed a little bit, only in terms of presentation, I think. Like, the mechanics are pretty similar, but all of the sounds have changed. Like, the impact noises are different, both for general punching and then for the kind of
advanced
you punching. Knocked this guy out noise. And that's... previously, those sounds were fucking perfect, and now I still think they're fucking brilliant. Like, in fact, that makes it sound like I think they're worse. I don't think they're worse. They're just kind of different, and I will probably end up liking these more. It's still extremely, extremely satisfying. And I think they've changed... Certainly Batman's moveset in general is just, you know, updated and different. So the moves he's doing is different. And it has a different feel to it, but is very much the same in the same vein of you swiftly and decisively break people's bones and perfectly counter everything they do. And it's just incredibly neat and fluid, and you dart between enemies seamlessly. But I think they've changed something about the ramping... You know, when you, like, in 300, when someone swings a sword at someone, they go into slow-mo kind of smoothly, like, they slow down time, and then speed it back up again. It's a kind of smooth thing. That's called ramping, apparently. And Batman's always done that, and I think they've changed kind of the rate at which it happens, because there's kind of just a different kind of, like, style to it. It feels like it emphasizes the strikes more, and it feels kind of even more decisive. I'm really interested to see how Catwoman plays, actually, because she felt very different in Arkham City. She was much less about decisive strikes, much more about flipping and doing loads of action to get the work done. Whereas Batman's kind of almost about minimal action. So I like all that. There's been a car jumping puzzle already, which was not fucking appreciated and incredibly counterintuitive, I thought. You can watch me for yourself, struggling with what the fuck I'm supposed to do once I'm on top of this roof, not really knowing if I should be on top of that roof or if I just got there by accident by fucking up a jump. And it turns out the answer is to drive directly away from your objective until a magic hotspot appears, which enables one of the functions of your Batmobile, which is otherwise disabled. Like, there's a button that doesn't do anything unless there's one of these context-sensitive things nearby, and the one that you have to use is behind you, and you only discover it if you drive away from your objective.
It was in front of me when I did that bit.
Oh, really?
I guess
it depends where you land on the roof.
Yeah, you park the wrong way. Yeah.
Because you have to... The thing it allows you to do involves driving directly away from your objective. And it's one of those things where it's like, the only reason you would do that is if you already knew the whole level layout, because you wouldn't go away unless you knew that that actually led to this other route that you discover by going that way that brings you back to your objective. Anyway, I'm not looking forward to any more of the Batmobile stuff. There's also Batmobile Combat, which is like against these tanks, and it looks shit in the trailers, and it's, so far it's not offensively shit because it's so easy, but it is just pure video games. There's just nothing about it feels like it's representing any real thing or comic book thing or any other type of, or cinematic thing. It's just pure video games. There's these magic metal blocks that fire, that emit a red laser warning you where they're going to shoot for 3 seconds, and if you strafe slightly, because your car can strafe in tank mode, then the red line goes blue to indicate you're not, they're not going to shoot you, and then they just shoot past you. It's like, nothing about that makes any sense as a kind of combat thing.
Like, aren't the blue lines projected by the Batmobile? Like, it's its targeting right, thing, that's, telling you where to be. I mean, that at least, it doesn't make any sense that Batman would know how to plan that. But at least it's not their tank telling you where to get out of the way. Like, yeah it is Batman things. But no, it is incredibly video game. Particularly because every time it introduces a new type of tank, later a different thing, someone, usually Alfred, will make a point of saying, Master Wayne, those tanks are unmanned. And Batman's like, cool, it's guns time. And then, you know, there's a bit later on with a helicopter that is previously manned, but becomes specifically unmanned so that you can then fight it. Which, like, there's no one in that helicopter, and there's like, disable the weapons lock, Alfred. Like, disable the arbitrary rule filter. It's time to be a tank for a while. There's even, like, you know, guard chatter about Batman having a tank now and how absurd that is. So obviously, like,
how does Alfred know? Where is Alfred?
In the Batcave, doing Batcave computer things, probably.
Watching.
Also, Lucius is watching you and delivers upgrades to you in the field. Like, just right at the start of the game, the Batwing has to fly in to pick up the Batmobile and just like bolt a new feature onto it just then and there. And it's like, what the fuck? Why did you build this system to like dynamically upgrade? Why didn't you just build the upgrade in the first place if you had the upgrade?
Like, the Lord
did
of
you just
like,
invent it in the last 5 minutes?
Where it's like, is it ready? It's like, well, you've only been out for 20 minutes.
You just left the house.
Have you got this? Isn't this product? It's either, you've either done it or it's right after where you're up to. You got the new suit yet?
Yes.
Yeah, where it's kind of like, where it's like, Lucius, I've got a hostage situation. I'm going to need it. Like, need what? And it's the new suit. They do the reveal of the new suit. It's like, well, what did you think was going to happen?
And encounter no enemies.
Why did you come out in the old suit in the first place? Like,
and it's to take down 3 guys. He specifically orders a new suit because he's like, there's a hostage situation. There's initially 5 people with guns pointing at hostages, and you're able to take out 2 of them quietly, but the other 3, there's no way to kind of get them one by one. So you call Lucius to ask, can you bring out the suit I need to take out 3 people? Because I thought I was only going to have to take out 2 people. Yeah. I actually need the 3-1.
In a city.
And he drops it in like a rocket pod that slams into the ground right outside the tense stealth situation where you're not allowed to alert the people to their presence.
And you can then have the option of doing 5 different AR tutorials, because the challenge stuff, like the kind of challenge maps, are now done kind of within the game. But the idea is it's kind of like this AR thing. And the way AR works is it's projected onto the real world. So not only is a rocket pod fired into that rooftop, Batman then spends 10-20 minutes on the rooftop pretending to punch people and like
just
pretending
gonna be like, I'm not gonna do this
in order to learn how to eat, and then goes inside. Like, there's a lot of I don't think that series has gotten any sillier in how it expresses itself. There's an amazing line right at the very beginning, and this isn't a spoiler because it is like very, very beginning. First conversation between Batman and Commissioner Gordon, where Gordon turns to Batman and says, Do you think Scarecrow's really crazy enough to set up a biological weapon? And the only sensible answer to that is, he's literally called the Scarecrow.
That's the only thing he does. That's
and don't ask me, because I'm dressed like a bat. Like, if it's like, who's crazy enough to do what? It's not really like a question you ask Batman. But also, like, the guard chatter is amazing now. Like, being a detective in Gotham is not fucking hard. Like, you can be swooping around in the air, and you'll hear just a random guy on the street corner going, are you thinking of going on with Two-Face's new thing? Because I hear he's got a thing going, some kind of crime. He's going to do a big crime. Lots of us are in. Are you in? And then Batman's swooping around like, that'll be important later.
World's greatest detective.
Exactly, just listening to dudes yelling on street corners about the crimes they're going to do. It's got some really good moments, actually. I just hit probably the first bit that you could seriously spoil. And it was proper cool. I did not see it. I didn't think they were going to do it in this game. Just a real cool Batman nerd moment. And more broadly, like, I mean, I think I said this before we recorded, that game is Batman porn, pretty much. Like, the intro, intro just sets up very, very quickly the notion that the city's kind of been evacuated. Now the whole of Gotham is just this playground for criminals. And then it does this kind of huge panning shot. It goes from, like, the shoulders of criminals in the streets all the way up to the rooftops and, like, flies across the city. And then there's this massive fuck-off bat signal goes up in the second, in the centre of it, and then it kind of pans right away around to the top of a tower where Batman's stood doing Batman standy things. And then you're in control immediately, seamlessly from the cutscene. You just dive off the roof and there's, like, rain slick on your cape, and it's like...
Oh. Yeah, it is really well framed, that even I noticed it, that much about Ampram. It's like one of those shots in movies where everyone admires the cinematography of it, only it's actually much easier to do in a video game because you can just move the camera up there. You don't need a special, like, rig for it. But the just the framing of, like, that signal appearing, you're kind of noticing that and where it is, and then sort of, I don't know what I was thinking exactly, but, you know, your mind goes to, oh, and then Batman will see that and go out, and then just as you're thinking that, you notice him. Like, it's just, he's in frame for a little bit longer, like, a little bit before you kind of spot him. And then just after you notice him, you realise, oh, I'm playing as him. Like, it's happened already.
The also the reveal of the Batmobile is just the most fanservice-y...
Most fetishistic.
It's like
every little detail on the hubcaps.
Yeah, and like
does it lower from the ceiling?
No, the standard option for like summoning the Batmobile is like LB on the Xbox pad that I'm using. And so normally that's the context sensitive button for like as long as you're looking at a flat piece of ground or the street, that's where you summon the Batmobile too, and you can do it as you're dropping and just land straight into it and stuff. It's very cool. But the first time you do it, it's part of like a scripted bit where it's like, you know, you've got to even the odds. And so press LB to even the odds. And it's like, but it's basically like press LB to yeah. And then you press LB and there's this kind of like, I think I've read something somewhere that they kind of sampled the noise of the Batmobile engine from like, it's like a tiger growling on like, and like a rocket going off at the same time. And they kind of heavily processed animal sounds and kind of piled all that in because you have this kind of like crazy roar. And then the Batmobile skids into view and then its hubcap, which has like a glowing bat sign on it, like hits the camera. And then it's just this sort of like fetishistic sort of leather fucking S&M car. Oh, it's so good.
There's I was in a situation where I wanted to use the Batmobile to solve a puzzle. I was just like, I needed the Batmobile. And I tried to press the button to summon it, and it was the first time I tried that in a situation where you can't do it. And the error message says, you must be on a road or looking at a road to summon the Batmobile. I've never had that error message before. You can't do this because you're not looking at a road. I was thinking, like, could I paint a road? Can I look at a stretch of land that looks like a road?
To its credit, there's some rad concept-sensitive stuff that obviously was very hard to do, like, that's really concept-sensitive where the Batmobile is and where you are and, like, so and what you're looking at. So there's you can be driving around the Batmobile, and this is after you get the second suit, but you can, if you're driving really, really fast, and there's a window up ahead with like enemies through it or whatever that the game deems to be breakable and highlights them in your kind of view, then there's a moment where if you kind of get the speed right, it'll kind of highlight the window, and then you like double tap A, and it will fire Batman out of the Batmobile and through the window, and it kind of goes through two different kind of like animation bits. One is the kind of being fired out of the Batmobile thing, but then seamlessly into the kind of like then crashing through a window and taking a guy out, and that is genuinely fucking rad. Like going from the driving bit, which is okay, but seamlessly into a combat in a way that it's just Batman-y as hell, like, is dead good. I really like that.
It feels like the Batmobile was a good idea in theory, but the tank combat maybe wasn't the way to explore it. Because I mean, that's not even a Batmobile-y thing. That's actually kind of almost the opposite of what you think of when you think of the Batman fantasy of being in the Batmobile. It's never like, and then he stayed still for a while and strafed slightly and then shot tanks.
There's, The Batmobile combat takedowns are funny. That's a thing that happens. If you're in a regular fist fight and the Batmobile happens to be nearby or has visual line of sight to you, one of your, rather than the regular break an arm takedown, it still uses combo meter, or like uses a separate combo meter, like the Batmobile watching you gets ready. Takes up, the Batmobile's like, yeah, kick him.
Just a couple more.
Yeah, and then you have a thing where you press like A and X or something. And Batman will like uppercut a guy, kick him into the air, and then the Batmobile will shoot him. It's like, good job, car. You're welcome, Batman. Yeah. Oh, it's good. I like that stuff a lot.
Can you... Because you could... Like, last time I saw on the Batmobile on a valid road, when I was looking at a road, it drove up and just knocked a lamppost over when it was trying to get to me. And so I was thinking, can you... Can't you just summon it in combat and have it come over and just run over the guys you're fighting?
It's weird, because if you run someone over, it, like, zaps them with this electric bolt that flies, flings them away from the Batmobile, which I think is a reference to, like... I think in one of the Nolan movies, like, if you try and, like, you know... If you try and, like, break into the Batmobile, it just electrocutes you.
Yeah. Mm.
And they kind of replace that as, like, this kind of, like... And they've explained that there are no civilians on the streets, so, you know, you're only running over bad people. A lot of people fucking die.
Yeah, a lot of those bad people are in very civilian-looking cars driving in a law-abiding way along the roads. I'm not sure how Batman has convicted them for these crimes.
What are the criminals doing now? Like, who are they robbing? Like, what's,
yeah, I'm not clear on that, because they intentionally evacuate the city. Like, the Scarecrow's first act is to try and get everyone out. And it's like, what crime are you going to do now? Beat each other up?
Yeah, they're kind of looting and stuff, I guess. But yeah, there's... And there's, like, you get these messages, like, there's a riot in progress. Why are they protesting? It's like, but it doesn't...
More of this!
Like, one of the things you can overhear is, like, this is great, we should do this all the time. Like, what, drive around? Like, hang around a street corner, not beating people up? Because you're literally surrounded by...
I love, like, this is how you deal with the crime problem in Gotham. Like, give it a just year or two, and all the criminals will just have formed a society. They'll just have jobs now. Like, it's been a year, there's no more crime to do. Yeah. Well, we need someone to bake bread so we can eat. Society forms.
Yeah.
They'll just learn. They'll just grow up.
Yeah, just feel this is a city full of complete assholes. Like, there's a certain amount of the population of that city, they're just dicks, and there's no way around it, really. Yeah, there's, you can go to, you can lock villains up in Gotham City Police headquarters and walk around the evidence room where they keep themed cabinets full of Batman villain gear that you can then look at for a handy recap of previous games, which is a nice feature if you missed stuff or just for kind of little cute Easter eggs and stuff, but doesn't really stop the kind of... It's not that it's gamey, it's that the world Batman occupies is completely ridiculous. I kind of like the way those games are treated that, though, where it is obviously almost this sort of steampunk metropolis as well, so they haven't kind of overcommitted to making it realistic at all. Mm. But, like, one of the first villains you encounter is Poison Ivy, and honestly nothing she says or does or even expresses makes any sense, really. You're going to try and get a read on her motivation. I like comics. It's just, like, you know, I've got two things in my character list. One is sexy, and plants. And the more we can combine those
sexy
things...
Plants, sexy?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you are bats and stoicism. So it's just sexy plants, sexy bats and stoicism. Sexy plants, sexy bats and stoicism.
They're a bit like Pokemon, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah, there's also a weird repeated line in the first half, and I imagine it's going somewhere where Oracle will phone up and say, "You should really involve Robin. This is quite serious." And Batman's like, "No."
Fuck Robin.
And then Robin will appear on the line to go, "I can't help." And Batman's like, "No, I'll do this one myself." And it's like, why? Like,
in Arkham City, if you don't have the DLC, Robin, like, shows up at one point, doesn't he? And then
Robin shows
Batman
up anyway.
Just tell him to go away, because you don't play as him.
No, Robin, the thing that happens with Robin in Arkham City actually does make sense. Basically, Batman sends Robin into the rest of Gotham. So, because, you know, the...
It's just, like, one area.
The plot of Arkham City is that, you know, the Joker has poisoned every blood bank in Gotham with his own blood. And so Robin does show up in the main campaign, and then Batman says, "I need somebody to go and sort out every other hospital in the entire city, not just this chunk of it that he's in." And then Robin goes off and does that, and you don't see him again to the end, which is fine.
Kind of an MVP.
But you know, it's kind of like, you know, that makes sense, whereas this is the entire of Gotham is under threat. So, like, I mean, apparently Robin is doing something important, but...
He's still fixing the blood banks.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty cool.
It is good.
Sounds
playing,
like,
you know,
they'll patch it, probably, and it'll be a good game.
Yeah, it's weird. I was really, really excited about it, and the problems I was warned of haven't turned out to be massive problems yet. I mean, the tank stuff is going to get tiresome. But I sort of forgot what these games were, and, like, there's most of the cool stuff is locked off from you at first, like right at the start, almost everything is locked up. Like, even just takedowns, you can't do until a specific moment where it introduces them. And so I remember a lot of that stuff in Arkham City and Asylum being locked off, being tied to the plot progress. Like, at this point, you get the line caster thing, so you can do the zipline thing. And so it was never, even when there was masses of side content to do, it wasn't really a good idea to do that in favour of the main quest. You should really do the main quest and get all the shit unlocked, and then you can mess around with all the cool abilities. And I sort of forgot about that bit, and so I was really excited about it, because the thing I've been playing Arkham City for again and again for years is the brawling challenge rooms, and I kind of want to do those, but then I also realised like I need to unlock a bunch of stuff. And also the side quests are apparently really good in this one, and I'm interested to get into those, but I feel like it's wasting time because I need to get to all the unlockable shit.
What else have you guys been doing?
I wanted to talk briefly about Dota Reborn, which I suspect is going to be a massive deal, and while there will be people already who are going to complain because I just said the D word.
Deal.
Yeah. Actually, this is the basically Valve said last year we're working on something really big. That's why we're not going to do any other updates. Everyone kind of knew it was going to involve custom game modes and converting the entire game to Source 2, which it's the first Source 2 game, is I suppose of wider interest as well. And then last week they opened up the public beta for Dota Reborn, and I was sort of expecting like a big deal, but not a new game. Like it's basically Dota 3. Like the interfaces, on a basic level, the interface has been completely revamped. The kind of the amount of new quality of life stuff is staggering. They really have rebuilt the game to the extent that basic Dota is bugged to shit at the moment. Like, as in, it's not like they could just port it one to one. They've had to absolutely rebuild the game, and there are crazy bugs everywhere, and like completely game breaking things, and you know, crazy exploits and stuff. And
can you still play the old one?
Yeah, so you basically have this. It adds this option where you then click when you click the launch Dota button, you get play Dota Reborn, load the toolkit. But the big thing, and the reason that I think it's just going to be a huge game changer, is the custom modes. So these are custom game types that you make with the toolset, which includes Hammer Editor, the Source 2 Hammer Editor, and a new like Lua scripting engine, and all this stuff. And it's basically a full game development suite. You have full access to the basic assets and scripts of Dota, but you are free to make anything else you want with it at all. People have made third-person shooters, they've made racing games, they've made football games. Like, you really could make anything with those parts, like, pretty much. Like, maybe you'd struggle with, like, to make Crusader Kings in it. But you can make a strategy game. You can make Warcraft, ironically. You can you know, someone's already made a fully working Bomberman game using Dota assets. But you can import whatever you want, so there's no reason to use Dota assets other than, well, it's convenient and all the animations are done for you, so if you just want a character who runs around to do things, it's all there. And then these game types can be freely shared using the Steam Workshop and voted up and voted down, but most importantly, all this happens within the game client. And all of it is supported by a kind of unified matchmaking lobby system, so you can instantly find players who are interested in the same game that you are, or invite your friends in, or host one yourself, and so on. And that is nuts. Like, that expands the potential audience for this game, which is already the most popular game on Steam, by a vast amount. Because the reason such a paradigm shift is, it's like, well, at the moment, if you don't like Dota, there's no reason to have Dota installed. When this is finished in later in the year, post internationals, probably September time, October time, you probably want to have Dota installed anyway, because what if you want to play some Bomberman? Like, what if you want to jump on and just play like a kind of co-op RPG dungeon crawler with your friends? What if you want to do Mario Kart knockoff with your friends, or play a strategy game or something like that, or just try out a new thing? And all of that stuff is completely free and, you know, easy to access and set up from within the game client. And so it's, you know, it's suddenly become as close to something like Little Big Planet as we have on PC, but with far more powerful tools. And that's crazy, because Dota was already pretty popular. Like, I ran some numbers, and like last week when I was checking this, Valve launched it with a mode they made themselves called Overthrow, and 22,000 people were playing that at the time. Which, if it was a game on its own, would mean that it would be in the top 20 to 30 on Steam, easily. Three times more people were playing Pudge Wars, a Dota custom mode based on a classic Warcraft 3 custom mode that doesn't even work. Three times more people were playing that than were playing Evolve. And, like, that game is as tanked as it is, but it's, like, for me, this is, you're kind of looking at what that service looks like in a year, and I suspect it involves people's, you know, I expect in a year to be sat here talking on this podcast saying, I found this custom mode for Dota that we should totally play because it's Gang Beasts but Magicka or something like that. Like, the amount you could do with it and its potential as a way into quick multiplayer game design for people.
Someone will make enormous. The Dota of Dota.
Yeah, and that's something that Valve said that. Like, they said that we're doing this because these sorts of tools were what created Counter-Strike and Dota in the first place, and we can make these tools better than they have ever been because there's no need to go to a dodgy modding site and download something and tweet loads of files. You just click a button and then it's there and you play it and you're instantly match-made with people if you want to find people to play it with and so on.
I remember there being a big deal about the StarCraft 2 editor when that came out.
The arcade.
Because you can use that to make games in radically different genres. And people did, but I never heard of anything coming out of it that sort of endured, as far as I know. Like, I haven't heard anyone talk about anything that was made in the StarCraft 2 editor since shortly after the StarCraft 2 editor was announced.
No, I know there were some like pretty major projects, like people trying to build a StarCraft MMO and that kind of thing. Like StarCraft Universe, they called it. I think that's still in development, and there's other things like that, but there's never been any kind of big breakout hit. How difficult is it to use the tools for Dota Reborn to make stuff, as compared to, well, I mean, Hammer Editor has been out for a while, so like versus doing something in TF2, which is also free to play and obviously had Hammer, how much easier would it be to do with the Lua scripting and the new tools?
So the Source 2 tools are, I think, much more straightforward in some ways than old Hammer was. Like, you can do, like, sort of, I think, like, dynamic terrain painting and stuff on the live game and that kind of thing. Like, a lot of more modern engines can. Like, I think CryEngine can do that.
Mm.
So you're not, like, rendering something to test it out. Or you're not compiling it and then testing it out. You're just... You know, it actually loads, when you load the tools, it also loads the game, so that you, and then you're basically editing directly into the game, which is the Source 2 thing, which I think will help a lot. It's not easy. Like, it's not a pick-up-and-play toolkit, but Hammer never was. It's a game development platform.
Yeah.
So, but by the looks of the way the scripting language works, that is, you know, mega accessible compared to, you know, traditional coding would be. You know, it uses the kinds of calls that already exist for Dota to work and use that to spin out to lots of different things. And that's kind of how Dota was made in the first place, because Warcraft 3 had provided all these hooks for people to develop things like hero characters that level up and AI that behaves in a certain way, and someone just twisted it and made something else out of it. And this is just about providing as many of those building blocks as possible. Like, I don't think you can make any game out of it. You probably couldn't make an FPS, right? Like, that would be probably beyond what you could do with it.
Valve already have games that let you do that.
But not with this toolkit. But, you know, in a way, it's sort of slipped under the radar because of E3, but this is, like, this is as close to a new game announcement of, and reveal as Valve done for a long time, because it's obviously taken a substantial amount of work, and, you know, they've massively refactored the rest of the game and changed everything about it in terms of the UI, and
it's very interesting to see what they do with Source 2 next, because it always sounds like if you make a custom game creator flexible enough, then do you need more than one of them? Like, do they need a custom game creator in all of their games, or is it just like, well, Dota's the platform now, so you can make it in that if you have an idea for a thing. I can certainly imagine them doing it for TF2, where you make your own custom game modes for that, because that's something where what most people would want to do with that is something quite close to what already exists. It's just, we want all soldiers versus all heavies or something like that. And there are loads of little tweaks like that you could make pretty quickly. But yeah, it's interesting because it's obviously a massively important thing to them to get this, to make tools for creators be easier to use and get them out there kind of in your face rather than being a separate SDK you have to download and set up. And so I wonder how that extends to all the other games.
Have either of you been following the development of the new Unreal Tournament?
No.
Only from occasionally proof-editing a magazine preview of it.
Well, I proof-edited an article about this today, which is will have just gone up on RPS as we're recording this by Ben Barrett. And it sounds, I mean, they announced that they were going to make it with the community helping. And it's an interesting case because they properly are just the community is building that game. Like, in a lot of ways, the community produce concept art that then gets selected by the developers to be the thing that they're going to. Yeah, that's what the rocket launcher now looks like. You know, you were taking your design and we're going to make it and we're going to animate it. And that is extended to, because it's all Unreal Engine 4, and Unreal Engine 4 is now completely free. The movement system in the game is one of the things they wanted to pin down really early on, because that's how they know how to design the weapons and the levels around the movement system. So there was huge community debates about, should you be able to double jump? If, how far should you be able to jump? And then people in the community built, like, plug-in tools for Unreal Engine 4 that they then released to the community built these and then released it to the rest of the community so that the community could really easily change and tweak those variables. So you could go in game and move a slider around to change the jump height and stuff like that and play around until they came up with what they thought was best and then show that to Epic, who go, all right.
And if you say that so.
Thing. Yeah. And it's like, it is kind of super interesting to see more and more developers going in that direction. Like, we've had mods for a long time, but moving more and more to the point of maybe a million people are smarter than 100 people. And, well, or at the very least, they can lead us in greater ways than they can, if we give them tools, than they can if we're just looking at the metrics and guessing.
Yeah. Sort of turning theory crafting into more practical experiments.
Yeah, if you double jump a man, he'll double jump for a day. But if you teach a man to configure his own variables for double jumping in an editor, then
he will find some good ones.
Yeah, sort how many times you should double jump.
He or somebody else will find some good ones.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Agreed.
The motion carries.
Natural as hell.
Seymour Mellon writes, two questions. Hi CNC, following your discussion of Dishonored's non-lethal gameplay and morality, I did appreciate that non-lethal options in that game were very different from the lethal ones and required care to use. Knocked out guards could still be killed by rats, drowning or falling. Of course, less lethal methods in real life are often A, deeply painful, and B, can kill, whereas in games, guns loaded with horse tranquilizers or savage beatings to unconsciousness are often made from existing lethal combat mechanics and treated as perfectly humane methods of dispatching enemies. What did the CNC team enjoy about non-lethal play? Have they played games which have non-lethal combat which is rich and distinct from lethal combat? Much thanks for the pod, Seymour.
Yes, I guess we've talked about Batman in this context.
That is lethal combat.
Yeah, but fictionally, non-lethal. We just pretend everybody survives their wounds. I always think that Human Revolution is the best version of it I've seen, where non-lethal options are different to lethal options and just harder. It's just more difficult because, and like most games, or lots of games that let you knock people out to have it be a time limit thing where they get back up after a certain amount of time, and that tends to be, that really just puts me off non-lethal altogether. I just think, well, yeah, you know, I'm never going to knock them out, particularly in a stealth game. I need to get past these guys. I need them to be out of the picture, otherwise it's just going to be a nightmare. Or I might as well ghost it if I'm going to have to get past them forever. So the way Human Revolution did it was that if you knock them out, they are out forever unless another guard sees them and then comes over and wakes them up, which is both sort of feels, once you grasp the rule, it's intuitive and you kind of, there are no questions about whether it will or won't happen, which is good, and just means that it brings that bit of challenge that used to be a time limit, moves it onto the active elements of the play field and makes you focus even more on those people, and tessellates nicely with a goal that you might have had for other reasons, for personal playstyle reasons, which is don't let guards find bodies, because that's often something that stealth games want to encourage anyway. And now there's a real like practical problem if a guard finds a body, which is you've got that enemy back now. I remember spending ages on that first proper level where God, I can't even remember what the facility you're infiltrating is now, but the one that that first terrorist has taken over.
it's like a Sarif factory, isn't it?
Zeke. Mad terrorist. Trying to go through that with the Trank rifle, which is, if you say, you know, at the start you have to say long range or short range, lethal or non-lethal. And if you say long range and non-lethal, they give you a Trank rifle, which is fucking hard mode, because it's difficult to hit anyone with it anyway, which is a bit weird. But then once you do knock them out, like, sniping with that is just difficult, because people can wake each other up at any moment, and you've got to try and take them all out before anyone else gets woken up by the ones who still remain. And also had the Pepsi gun, which was fucking awesome. And in general, I think, like, I wish more games would do sort of, would treat physics takeouts as non-lethal. Are those words that make sense? Like, knocking people over into stuff is really, really inherently fun. And knocking people out often isn't that satisfying. Like in Deus Ex 1, it was, the Trank dart was shit. It was, you had to shoot them, and then it would just sort of, they'd play the hurt animation once every 2 seconds for the next 10 seconds, and while they were doing that, they'd be running around yelling, just completely non-stealth.
I've been tranquilized!
Trank me! JC Denton is here! Trank me with his Trank dart! I've been Trank! Look out for the Trank guy!
So that's how mic level's fucked.
But it's something I'm thinking about at the moment, because I'm doing it in Heat Signature. I've just added unconsciousness. But only for the player right now. Look, like guards, they're effectively dead. Once you knock them out, they never get back up. But I'm probably going to steal Deus Ex's thing where they can be woken up by other guards. But also, the reason I have to add unconsciousness is because I've just made it so you can throw your... You can throw anything, throw any item that you can hold. And that includes a wrench. And if you throw a wrench at someone, it should knock them out. And if you throw a wrench at a wall, it should bounce. And if you throw a wrench at a wall and you're standing in front of the wall, it should bounce back and hit you, and so it should knock you out. And the fact that wrenches currently kill enemies is not a big deal, because it's like, well, you know, that's not a massively important distinction just yet. But if a bouncing wrench kills you permanently, then a lot of very short games are going to happen, because it's the first thing you do. You just board a ship, you throw a wrench, hits a wall, hits you in the head. And if that kills you permanently, it would be very funny, but only the first couple of times. Yeah. So I had to add a system where you actually do fall unconscious for a certain amount of time, then get back up, and then realize that should be the system for enemies, but probably they should have to wake each other up. But yeah, I'm also thinking about maybe having like a non-lethal ammo type, and the way I would do it is just to have it be kind of like force bullets. Like, I don't know what they'll be fictionally, but they'll just knock people back loads and slam them into walls, and that'll be what knocks them out.
Or kills them outright.
Well, fictionally, no, it's totally alive. But it will. I do like the thing the questioner references about how in Dishonored, once they're down, even if they're going to stay down, you still have to be careful with their body. Like, their body can die. So,
yeah.
And obviously, Heat Signature, things get sucked out into space quite a lot. So if you knock someone out and they get sucked out into space, that person is now dead.
I did have a lot of instances in Dishonored where I would accidentally consume an unconscious body with rats, and I was trying to do a no-kill playthrough at that point. That is a kind of problem. He's talking about how less lethal methods, you know, because they're an extension of the same combat system, are often just technically lethal methods, but they just don't happen to kill the person. But the thing that makes them rich and distinct isn't the combat itself, but that the consequences of it are granular, so it feels like you're engaging with the other systems of the game in a much more meaningful way, rather than it just being a binary decision of man is dead, man is not dead. It's man is unconscious, man can get discovered, man can become dead, man can be found. I always play non-lethally in games where I can, basically, because it feels like a more interesting experience for it. I really love Hitman Blood Money for the same thing. That experience of teaching on the edge of failure that you get from continually failing, basically.
This question will say a lot about me, but what are the non-lethal options in Blood Money? I don't think I ever really explored them.
Well, you always
Hitman,
have to...
Hitman, but not too hard.
You always have to...
You can punch people.
Yeah.
And then there's a knockout syringe.
Yeah.
Is there chloroform as well? Is that...
I don't think there's chloroform as an actual weapon, although I think you can use it in certain contexts.
In any new life, you can put it on the underwear that the bodyguard sniffs.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention that. But yes. Yeah, I think you always have to assassinate your target, right? You can't ever complete a mission by...
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There's no dishonored abductions.
Invisible Ink does as well, because it ties lethality and non-lethality into a kind of an economic system where lethality makes the level easier because you've removed a guard, but harder because all the guards are fitted with heart monitors that advance the security track if you kill them.
Yeah.
So it's a resource balancing game where it's basically what do you want? Time? Because if you want time, the best thing to do is kill them, because you have to sit on them forever and stop them from waking up. But if what you want is... But if you're less bothered about that and you're going in for a quick run and you have the bullets and you can afford that stuff, then actually killing people is more efficient in a way. One thing I like about the game as well is that the fiction, like a lot of sort of future sort of... One of the things that's sort of implied by that fiction is that life is quite cheap. Like, you don't really ever get a sense of the people that you're taking down as people, but it almost is that sense comes from the world the game is set in, not just the game. Like, you're invading these sort of faceless mega corporations for whom all their employees are these chip-implanted guards that are sort of summoned into buildings just to do a thing, and it sort of suits the fiction that you wouldn't necessarily... So the distinction between lethal and non-lethal would actually be a practical one rather than a moral one, because life is massively cheap in the world where the game is set. So I do quite like that.
There's, it's really cool because there's loads of interesting things you can do with that, because a heart monitor is an electronic device, and so if you have someone with an EMP device, they can neutralize a heart monitor and then you can kill them for free. And so, like, at first, the fact that killing comes at such a high cost, the way I read that as the player was, oh, they just don't want you to kill. They're just saying, don't kill. Like, not, it's not impossible if you absolutely have to do it. Like, if you have one of your agents trapped, then obviously better to kill them than to die. But we're basically saying, don't kill. This game isn't about killing. You should tase people. And then you realize, but if I just turn off their houses, I can just kill them for free. And you realize, like, I've just found a way out of morality. Like, that was the only thing stopping me, really.
The EMP, the disables ethics. The ultimate Tom Clancy novel.
Ethics, magnetic pulse.
Yeah.
I haven't really ever killed anyone in Invisible Ink, because I kind of feel bad about it.
Killing a robot.
I'd much rather... Yeah, I'll kill a robot.
That's not even really killing.
But I would much rather spend the resource of, one of my unit's attention to just settle on that person for the rest of the game. Like, I
Which is
bargained
probably
for that.
Not... In most cases, probably not the right decision, like, from a practical point of view, because if you usually have two agents and one of them sitting on someone forever, it's like, well, now I only have one agent. Whereas shooting them, you're trained to avoid raising the alert level, but actually raising it like two pips is kind of nothing, really. Like, it'll...
What's a man's life worth?
I'm just repeatedly advocating killing people for some reason. But yeah, I've always... I'd almost never do it in Invisible Ink, but... I'm always... Every time I'm controlling a character who does have a lethal gun, it's always interesting to me that every unconscious person has a gun icon next to them, because, like, anything you can shoot has to have a shootable icon on it. And in most cases, it makes sense, because, like, an enemy, obviously you want a crosshair icon on them, because you might want to shoot them. But the fact that it puts on bodies, I always feel like is a weird suggestion. Shoot, what? I wasn't thinking about that. Shoot the body?
So you don't want to kill this sleeping man?
But that would be useful in some situations.
Yep.
I even advocate shooting unconsciously.
Jeff Smith from Toronto asks, "Hello, Containers and Debrainers. Great podcast. I love how quickly it gets started and how you've trimmed out all but the two important sections from the PC Gamer podcast deck." What were the other sections?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Steam Top 10. Oh, big old list of Sims expansions.
It used to be the actual charts, like the shop charts. Yeah. You read out what was selling in shops, and it was always Sims expansion.
Let's find out what they actually are.
Six of them will still be Sims expansion packs.
It's quite weird. It's always been weird, I guess, the Steam charts. It's always things you don't really expect.
We have Batman Arkham Knight, Ark, Survival Evolved. Unfortunately, the rest of it isn't like word association. Grand Theft Auto 5, Counter-Strike, Steam Controllers, Witcher, Wild Hunt, Batman Arkham Knight Premium Edition, The Elder Scrolls Online, Tamriel Unlimited. Lego Worlds and Rust. There you go.
Okay, that's actually pretty. That's not that surprising. I looked at it yesterday and, like, I guess maybe this is because it was only pre-orderable, but Batman just literally wasn't in there at all, like, on an hour before it launched. So maybe they just exclude pre-orders these days.
Who knows?
Now, but I also talk remember about all those games, one by one.
But I also remember Fallout 4 being in the charts, so that can't be right.
That's weird.
Like, because it was announced on E3 and then it was just in the Steam charts. Like, whoa!
I think we used to take news more seriously as well. This wasn't the guy's question at all, was it?
No,
we
I love how you get straight to the point. I don't you at all.
He continues. Fantastic! But thankfully not cat fantastic. Burn. Anyway, my question is this. It seems obvious why developers often use violence as a challenge within games. Fighting for your pretend life is easy to understand, and it seems likely you will feel gratification if you succeed at the challenge. It has been argued that violence in games is bad, but that only leads to my question. What other concepts or challenges are as compelling as violence, which could be explored by developers? I think learning and exploring would be some, but there must be others. Thanks, Jeff.
I think you already do a fair bit of learning and exploring in games. It's just the way you're learning is weird bullshit rules.
About killing people.
Yeah. How to kill. Rules. Who to kill.
Press X to stealth kiss your wife and then press X to stealth murder an Uruk.
Yeah.
The thing that sprung to mind when I read this question was socialising. Basically, conversations. Just talking to people and getting things to do things.
Trying not to humiliate yourself.
Yeah. Actually, in games, like in Human Revolution, they do this, and it's a specific, they call it like conversational combat, and it's a, you know, arguing. You are trying to persuade, in every case, you're actually trying to persuade someone to do something specific for you, and that's how they turn into something antagonistic, or at least challenge-like. But, as you say, actually, like, a more realistic challenge would just be how not to embarrass yourself in a conversation. That's a challenge. But it's proved difficult for developers to richly simulate.
I don't think it's impossible. I think it's just a question of, like, adding more consequences to how the player behaves within, like, a, you know, a conversation tree system. Like, you know, the games like BioWare games or any of the recent big CRPGs are designed so that they don't break if the player accidentally clicks something or goes, or cancels the conversation and goes back in to do it again. But if you had a game that actually acknowledges that that happened, which they sometimes do, you know, they sometimes make a joke of, like, why'd you ask so many questions or whatever, but I would like the game that you do only kind of get one run at every given conversation, because that's how conversations work. You know, if I ask you how your day was, and we talk about that for a bit, and I wasn't satisfied with how it went, and I said, how was your day? Then it would be embarrassing for me personally, because I would think I was weird. And I'd quite like it to be replicated within a game, so that actually getting through that conversation with the information you needed, but not coming across as a weirdo, was a genuine challenge, because it is.
I've mentioned this game on the podcast 1,000 times, but I can't help myself. But Mass, as Chris just named, is great precisely not just because it has that very high drama conversations where you've got a gun pointed at you, but just conversations with your wife where she can leave mad at you, you know, if you fuck it up and you don't get
it. Yeah, you can ruin your marriage in that case.
And, you know, it has a little bit of time pressure and a little bit of you can just choose to say nothing. Sometimes that's a valid option and sometimes not. And that's really compelling. The other thing I thought of in terms of gratification, and it's not a challenge, but is creativity, surely. You just read out the Steam charts and Lego Worlds is on there. And it's a Lego game that's obviously a little bit Minecrafty in the sense that Minecrafty is a little bit Lego-y. But it's not a game that's got any survival mechanics or anything like that, and there's no limits on what you can build whatsoever. Just you do discover like presets and stuff and new characters that you can add to your builds, but from the beginning you just have an infinite supply of blocks that you can place in any order or positions you want. It's number 9 on the Steam charts at the moment, and it's super early alpha. And it's just really cool. People like building stuff. I think we mentioned this on the podcast before, but I'm always reminded of the original TIG source thread for Minecraft, where, like, almost as soon as Notch posted it and said, hey, I've been working on this little thing for 3 weeks, here's a build of it, you know, within 2 hours, someone posted a screenshot of a bridge that they built, and the bridge was 1 block wide and 4 blocks long.
Like, look at what I made! Yeah. For years, people will marvel at my creation. And then, no one will ever make anything this good in Minecraft, I don't think.
And then just over the next 24 hours is just like 40 posts, and it's all just people posting screenshots of, hey, I made this thing, hey, look, here's my world. It's just instantly people want to share the thing that they're making, no matter how lousy it is.
The interesting thing about LEGO Worlds, if it's successful, which it seems to be, will be when Minecraft came along and its success was so enormous, and it was obviously related to this, to the creativity part of it. It seemed like, oh, well, yeah, it makes sense that that's massively popular, or it makes sense that, you know, a thing like this will eventually get massively popular, the thing where you can build anything to a certain degree of resolution. But it also, at the same moment it proved to be massively popular, it seemed like, but also, like, how would you, this almost doesn't feel like a genre that we should now explore with a bunch of other games, because it feels like, well, we've already got the one where you can build anything. What are you going to make? The other game where you can build anything?
Yeah.
But LEGO kind of, for a while, it seemed like for LEGO they just missed the boat, because they did LEGO Universe. Was it called LEGO Universe?
The name LEGO Universe was their MMO, yeah.
And that was, like, didn't have the appeal of Minecraft. And it felt like, you know, kind of too late to do a Minecraft. But actually, from reading Marsh's preview of LEGO Worlds, it sounds like it actually is quite an interesting twist on it, in that you have these prefab things, and making blocks to build things from scratch are free, but these pre-made things cost you a certain amount of a resource that you have to kind of, I don't know if you harvest it or you get it from things you kill, maybe.
Yeah.
In murder. It's really about combat, the game.
You can beat up, like, zombie minifigs or whatever, and steal their blocks that and wear their faces.
But it kind of makes sense, because that's how LEGO works, right? There's sets, and there's... I mean, it's not how it works commercially. You don't get free blocks. There's no free blocks ever. But there's this big dividing line, which actually is reflected in LEGO Movie as well, between free building and pre-made sets. And the game is saying, the free building, just do it wherever you like, limitlessly, like Minecraft Creative Mode. And then these pre-built things that have kind of some unique kind of content that's been made by the developers of the game, or LEGO, depending on how you think of it, that has value and is something that you can make it, but it costs you something. And I think they're also like, they can be like vehicles and sort of functional things that maybe you couldn't have built yourself.
Like, right from the off, you can just spawn vehicles, which is just super cool. Like, Martian is right up for RPS, describes like a burrowing kind of digger that you're using to flatten
land,
and he
great.
Gets out of it. And then, like, a caveman, because he's in the caveman world, runs over and gets inside his digger and then just, like, crashes it into the ground and takes a big hole into his world. Just sounds fun. Like, it doesn't sound like a game, it just sounds like a big playground at this stage, which is super cool. James Glover writes, crate, never crowbars.
I really like that one. It took me a long time to get what it was referencing, but...
Right, well,
it's war
James. So I'm just listening to the excellent No Such Things as a Fish podcast, hot in the back of the excellent Crate and Crowbar podcast. No Such Things as Fish is run by the QI researchers. So lots of interesting facts, albeit with a slightly flexible definition of fact.
Weirdly, my friend Andy, who I used to do comedy with, is on that podcast. So yes, it is a very small world.
An interesting fact.
Sort of.
Quite
stretch your definition.
Yeah. In it, they mentioned that's all right. That bottle doesn't have anything in it. In it, they mentioned research that suggests that people wearing a lab coat perform slightly better in various intelligence tests. This suggests that the +5 science buffs on wearing a lab coat and Fallout, etc., aren't quite as crazy as game logic as they first appear.
Did they consider that that's because the people in lab coats are scientists? People who aren't wearing lab coats.
We found people who are wearing lab coats. They seem to be much better at
them in the streets. These guys are just great at science. We don't know why.
You've covered things games have taught you before, but what about lessons you've had to relearn in real life, only because you assumed that the game couldn't possibly be accurate?
I found this question to be too specific to answer. I don't know of anything else like that, but that was an interesting story.
I suppose I could use the example of driving, which is, like, I think I'm pretty good at vehicles in games. Fly things, could drive fast, could do spaceships, fail my driving test four times 10 years ago and have never gone back.
Same here.
So some things aren't transferable, for sure. I think maybe it matters a lot when you're not allowed to crash the car a lot.
Yeah.
When you're only allowed to crash a tiny bit. It's a lot harder.
I don't really have an answer to the question, but there's lots of other things similar to his anecdote. For example, people near hand sanitizers will give more conservative answers to questions.
Wow.
Local
debuffs in the real world.
Yeah. So hang on, when you say conservative answers, do you mean like...
like on the cautious. Political spectrum.
Oh, really?
Were the hand sanitizers near the Republican headquarters?
Maybe. It's the idea of priming, which I mostly know via the talks that the developers of League of Legends have given at GDC over the years. They've done a few. They didn't do one this year, but the last two or three years before that they have, because they have a department devoted to this as part of their kind of player behavior division, trying to get people to act less like dicks and more like nice people during matches of League of Legends. And they did a bunch of, they still do a bunch of experiments with, for example, the loading screens before matches, what colors they show you, what messages they show you, and certain colors change the likelihood of you being an asshole in the game that follows. And there's stuff as well, like apparently seeing the color red lowers your performance in skill-based tests afterwards. So, you know, if you're setting an exam at school, don't wear a red t-shirt. Because statistically, you'll do worse.
There's a really weird example of priming an economist named Ariely, I can't remember his surname, did for the Economist's paper, where they offered... Actually, I can't remember if maybe the Economist paper did this and he found out about it. But they did one offer where you could either get the digital subscription or the paper subscription and the digital subscription. And digital alone was like, let's say $20, and the physical and digital was $40. And 80% of people went for the digital only. And then they kept those two things the same, but also introduced the physical edition alone as a new option that was like $39. So only $1 cheaper than the thing. And of course, nobody bought that. Nobody bought the new option. But the ratio shifted to 80% of people bought the combined version and only 20% bought the digital only. So the two options stayed exactly the same, but they added a third option that no one wanted, and it completely reversed the what people spent on.
That's nuts. Basically, human beings are terrifyingly easy to manipulate. And we're probably all being manipulated right now in ways we don't understand.
Tom's wearing a red t-shirt. Which means that if I fail at whatever game I play after we finish with this podcast, it's his fault for priming me for failure.
That's why I just talked shit for the last hour and a half.
I really ruined it all.
At least we now have someone to blame.
And that's all the time for questions that we've got.
If you'd like to send us questions, you can do so at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet at us at crateandcrowbar on Twitter. You can write questions on our forum, crateandcrowbar.com/forum. And you can follow us on Twitter individually. I'm at Pentadact, PENTADACT.
I am at Gonnas, GONNAS.
I'm at C Thurston, that's CTHURSTEN.
And thank you for listening, everybody.
That was very professional.
Yeah, it's because he can't see his own t-shirt.
Gonnas failed to do it entirely.